Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer, historian, political theorist, and teacher Howard Zinn. Zinn grew up in a working-class family in Brooklyn, New York, where he became a shipyard laborer and later, during World War II, an Air Force bombardier. He attended Columbia University under the GI Bill and earned a Ph.D. in history. He has written over 24 books, including Disobedience and Democracy, his autobiography You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, and the highly celebrated A People's History of the United States. He recently released a companion volume, Voices of a People's History of the United States, and I'm speaking to Howard Zinn by phone from his home in Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Howard Zinn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, I'm glad to be there.
Listen, I want to talk to you about some of our recent history of the last half dozen years or so. Shortly after the 2000 election, when Bush was placed in the White House by the Supreme Court instead of the American people, you said in an interview that you felt you were living in an occupied country. What are you feeling now?
I'm still occupied.
Yeah.
The country is still occupied. I mean, what does it mean to be living in an occupied country? It means some alien group has come into your country and taken over and subjected everybody in the country to its power and behaved ruthlessly in violating human rights. And yes, I feel that although we are constantly talking about the fact that we are occupying Iraq, which of course we are, mm-hmm. what we very often fail to recognize is that not only is Iraq occupied by the American military, but this country is being occupied by a small group of men who, as you pointed out, were put into power 5 years ago by the Supreme Court and then took total power for itself, and this is a group of people who seem to have no concern for human rights, whether abroad or in this country, who have no concern for the environment, who are taking the great wealth of this country and expending it on war and military budgets. And that's why I very often, yes, I wake up in the morning, I look at the headlines, I look at the latest casualty reports, I look at the chaos in the in Iraq, and I think, yes, the American people have been occupied.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We know that he was placed in the White House by the Supreme Court in 2000. What do you think about this last election? Do you think it was stolen as well?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was. After all, it was a very, very close election.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ohio, there's a lot of shadowy goings on around the voting machines. Huge difference between the exit polls and what the final results were that were tabulated. And I know there are people who have gone into this much more carefully than I have and who have concluded that indeed the election of 2004 was one that was manipulated in some way so as to give the Bush administration a victory. So, as I say, I don't know for sure exactly what happened, how it happened. I wouldn't swear to it. But, you know, given what we know of the Bush administration, of its underhandedness, of its ruthlessness, of its willingness to violate the law, its concern for power, and I would not at all be surprised if they did everything they could to make sure that Bush would win.
I think a lot of people feel that way. Do you think there have been any positive changes at all in this country in direct correlation to 9/11?
Positive changes in this country?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the positive changes have not come from the top. That is, there are no positive changes emanating from Washington. Whatever positive changes there have been have come from what I think is a growing awareness on the part of the American people, that they have been deceived, that they have been pushed into a deadly war, a war that has taken 2,000 lives and crippled and maimed many thousands more. A growing recognition on part of the American people that they have been manipulated into war, and a growing awareness that that this administration has lied to them, has usurped power. That, to me, is something positive that has happened, because, you know, when we look for something to give us hope, we can't look for it in the White House or in Congress or in the Supreme Court. We have to look for it in the activities of ordinary people whose basic common sense and decency leads them eventually. I say eventually because mm-hmm. they can be fooled and their common sense can be distorted and their sense of decency can be manipulated. But eventually they learn, and their good instincts come to the fore. And I think that is the positive thing that has been happening.
Mm-hmm. Even though it's taken a while, I mean, it seems to me that the American public's finally seeing what some of us saw all along, you know?
Mm. Yeah, it has taken a while. Well, remember, during the Vietnam War, it took several years before we had an anti-war movement that was strong enough to begin to shake the conviction of the administration that it must continue the war. It took several years in the Vietnam War, and it took many more years, even after there'd been a majority of the people opposed to the war, it took many more years for the war itself to come to an end. So given the power of the government to manipulate public opinion, given the fact that we have a political system where there is no real opposition in what is supposed to be the opposition party, mm-hmm. it's not surprising that it takes a long time for the will of the people to be translated into public policy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk to you about David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, in which he questions the official story about 9/11 and really suggests that the Bush administration might have been involved. Well, what do you think of that? Is it a conspiracy theory, or is it something that really should be being investigated?
Well, it is a conspiracy theory, but on the other hand, there are conspiracies. So, I think it certainly should be investigated. I mean, they sent me the book with which I read, and Professor Griffin puts together a huge amount of very persuasive evidence about the possible complicity of the Bush administration in what happened. And, I mean, I don't know for sure that that is exactly what went on. I'm not, it's a very, very complex set of facts. Mm-hmm. Need to be looked into, but I certainly think it shouldn't be dismissed. And my reaction to the book was not, oh, well, you're absolutely right, I believe everything you say. My reaction to the book is, well, you have given me enough information to lead me to say, well, yes, this deserves looking into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read the book as well, and I agree. It should be investigated. I know you're not a fortune teller, but what do you think history will make of our current disastrous adventure in Iraq? Do you have any feelings about that?
Well, what history will make of it, I think, of course, a lot depends on which historian you will turn to 20 years from now.
Absolutely.
Or 30 years from now, because after all, historians today will differ in their analysis of what happened in 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. But just as in the case of Vietnam, while the immediate judgment was a very flawed one, that is that there was a rush to support the Vietnam War at the beginning because people simply had no alternative sources to turn to but the president and the secretary of state. the time did come when people learned, and history now, I think it's fair to say that except for a relatively small number of people who insist that the Vietnam War was moral rights necessary, you know, I'm thinking of Henry Kissinger,
yeah,
Alexander Haig,
exactly,
and people like that. Mm-hmm. Aside from a small, relatively small number of people like that, I think most Americans now, in the perspective of history, know that the Vietnam War was a misbegotten war, was wrong, was futile, was in fact not just a mistake, but a kind of calculated mistake on the part of the government, which resulted in the deaths of several million people in Vietnam and 50,000 deaths among American soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And do you see parallels in that Johnson and some of the leaders during the Vietnam War would not admit that they were losing and that they were wrong? And the same thing seems to be happening with the Bush administration.
Oh, yes, even more so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true, the Johnson administration held on fast to the idea that, yes, we were winning, there'll be light at the end of the tunnel. And so they kept pouring more and more men and more resources into the war. And after all, when Johnson came into office, you know, there were perhaps, you know, 35,000 American troops in Vietnam, and soon it was 100,000, 200,000, 400,000, 500,000, all on the supposition as, oh, if he's just send more troops, you know, we will win the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was no way they could send more troops to win the war because the people of Vietnam were opposed to the American presence in Vietnam, and you can't win a war against a hostile population. And the same thing is happening today. The Bush administration is even more entrenched in its certainty than the Johnson administration was. Within the Johnson administration, there were sort of hesitating voices. Even Johnson himself, if you listen to the tapes that are now available of Johnson's conversations with Richard Russell and other people of his administration, Johnson himself had certain qualms about the war. The Bush administration shows no such qualms.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to have sort of built a steel wall around this little group of people in Washington, sort of impervious to public opinion. And yet, I think the wall is beginning to crack. Even, you know, people on the right, even people who consider themselves conservatives, have now begun to speak out and say that this war is lost. I'm thinking of William Buckley. I'm
mm-hmm.
thinking of George Will. I'm thinking of, you know, former generals who are now saying that the war is a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it finally is starting to crumble, it seems. Do you sense, as many of us do, and I talk to people about this a lot, that we are living in sort of Huxley's Brave New World? Because, I mean, this war on terror is never-ending, and the population seems to be pretty high on consumerism and happy drugs. And do you feel any sense that we may be involved in Brave New World at this moment in time?
Sad to say, but certainly there's a strange disconnect between what I just spoke about, a growing awareness of the fact that, yes, the war is wrong, and the Bush administration really has deceived us, and on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, yes, it's a consumer culture, and we have a 1,000 ways to amuse ourselves. Well, Neil Postman some years ago wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the whole idea of circuses to divert the mind of the population. And Huxley was way ahead of his time,
mm-hmm.
in predicting how the public could sort of be turned away from a critical understanding of what is going on. So we're, you know, it's something that is a problem, but it's not a problem that can't be overcome. And because ultimately people, you know, they can amuse themselves and amuse themselves, but the casualty lists grow, and the theft of the nation's wealth and the economic uncertainty grows. And at a certain point, no degree of amusement is going to shield Americans from that reality.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is historian and writer Howard Zinn. So, I want to take up the subject of the war on terror. What do you think about this overall engagement, which has really no face and no enemy, and could be continuous?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's a good thing to talk about the way the war on terror has been used to create an atmosphere of fear. And I think it's worth comparing it to the fear of communism in the 1950s and how fear throughout American history has been used to control the population. You know, and back in the Revolutionary War, the fear of Irish revolutionaries and French revolutionaries enabled Congress to pass the Alien and Sedition Acts, you know, and fear of anarchists and in the time of World War One led to putting people in prison and raiding the homes of people who were not citizens of this country, and so you know the Cold War period, that long period of conflict with the Soviet Union, was one in which, you know, the fear of communism led to the most absurd kind of things, both here in this country and in our foreign policy abroad. So I think, you know, that's something we can talk about.
A lot of people are concerned about this war on terror because it seems to be being used as a tool to keep people in fear, and this is the way Bush has propped himself up. So I think it is something that we need to be concerned about in the future as well, don't you?
Oh yeah, and a historical perspective helps. That is, it helps for people to look back and see how the word communism was used in the 1950s in the same way that the word terrorism is used today. And just throwing out the word communism led to people losing their jobs, led to huge numbers of people being put on FBI lists, led to loyalty oaths you know, children crouching under desks, being told that the Russians were coming and this would protect them.
You know, I remember that even from my childhood in the 50s, that we used to have to get under the desk and they do these drills. It was unbelievable, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, now it looks absurd, but at the time, in the spell of anti-communist hysteria, just as you know, today in the spell of anti-terrorist hysteria, that spell, it was accepted. And, you know, you would get bizarre things happening, like, you know, a congressman getting up and on the floor of the House of Representatives and opposing mobile libraries that would bring books into the rural areas because he said that educating people is the first step towards communism.
Mm.
And, you know, you'd get people being put on FBI lists because they went to a Paul Robeson concert.
Yeah.
So, you know, and today, I mean, I was just reading today about a scholar in Switzerland who was offered a very distinguished scholar in Muslim studies, in Islamic studies, offered a job as a professor at Notre Dame University, and the United States would not let him take the job, would not allow him into this country Why? Because they use the Patriot Act.
Oh, gosh.
You know, mm-hmm. the Patriot Act says, well, if somebody, you can keep somebody out of the country if they have supported terrorism. Well, this guy, there's no evidence that this guy has supported terrorism. In fact, he has spoken out and written extensively, his writings are available, against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter, because all you have to do is utter the word terrorism, and immediately the government does what it wants.
Yeah, it's really scary. You know, I want to go back to something that you were talking about earlier about how the Democrats have been missing in action, and then the Republicans do, I mean, they're heading further and further to the right. Are you worried about this point in our democracy when we seem to have absolutely no checks and balances?
Yeah, well, you know, the truth is that this is not a new thing. That is, on matters of foreign policy, on matters of going to war, that we've never had real checks and balances. I mean, if you look at the Vietnam War, both Republicans and Democrats joined. The Vietnam War was carried on by Democratic presidents and mm-hmm. Republican presidents. And Congress, Democrat and Republican congressmen, supported a war until the very end. And so bipartisanship in foreign policy is an old matter. It's just that there are certain times when not to have an opposition party is particularly dangerous. And when you are embarked in a war which is illegal, immoral, which is wasting the resources of the country, both the human resources and the other resources of the country, when you're in a situation like this, you desperately need an opposition. And when you don't have an opposition, you're in a desperate state. And, of course, that's the point at which you need popular agitation and organization. That's when you need social movements to arise. And it was that lack of balances and checks in the Vietnam War. The fact that Congress and the Supreme Court would not do anything about ending the war that led to people who organized themselves and to create a popular citizens' movement.
Mm-hmm.
And only the creation of that movement created the kind of check and balance that we needed.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought Cindy Sheehan was going to start helping to resurrect some kind of an anti-war movement, but that seems to have fizzled. Do you see any real anti-war movement on the horizon?
Well, I do. I mean, remember that Cindy Sheehan's action was joined by hundreds of actions around the country
mm-hmm.
at the time. But this is the way movements are. They rise and fall. You know, but the general direction in this country has been, I think, in the growth of an anti-war movement. And we are going to see this coming weekend, the 3 years after the beginning of the war in Iraq, we are going to see this weekend demonstrations all over the country against the war.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an anti-war movement. But remember, the anti-war movement now is not national, it's localized, it exists in hundreds and hundreds of places around the country. It is not reported in the press or on television, and so people in one part of the country have no idea what people in another part of the country are doing.
Mm-hmm. So it really has turned into a grassroots movement then, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's quite a strong anti-war movement here in the Ithaca area, so... I understand what you're saying, yeah. Do you still believe that the Democratic and Republican parties are pretty much alike? I know you've said that in the past.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can find small differences between them, but on critical matters like war, it's very hard to find a difference between them. And look, you have one Democratic senator from Wisconsin, Russ Feingold,
yes. mm-hmm.
who introduces a resolution of censure, and which is really a mild thing. It doesn't go as far as impeachment.
Right.
it's just a little sort of slap on the wrist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can't find other senators in the Democratic Party who will support him.
Yeah, I heard that Barbara Boxer came on board today.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to hear that.
Me too.
That's two.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely unbelievable to me how cowardly the Democrats have been.
Yeah, and I think it's up to people to push their representatives and to demand of them that they speak out, because otherwise, you know, it's a mockery to talk of us having representative government or democracy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the Bush administration has pushed secrecy to dangerous levels in regard to our notion of open government and open democracy? Or has this always been the way it's been?
Well, you know, you might say about the Bush administration that all these terrible things that have happened in this country, whether foreign or domestic policy, have existed before, but the Bush administration has taken all of those things and brought them to the highest and worst level possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we've had secrecy, government secrecy, for a long time.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
All of the secret actions that our government took back in the 50s to overthrow the government of Iran and the government of Guatemala and the government in the 70s, the government of Chile, and mm-hmm. all sorts of secret things going on, control of information. But the Bush administration has gone farther than all of them. You know, there's a law passed some years ago. Well, it was actually right after the Nixon resignation, saying that the presidential documents, records, letters, and so on have to be open to the public 12 years after the president leaves office.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Bush administration has done away with that.
Yeah,
now the records of presidents can be kept secret indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mm-hmm. if you have a war on terror that's indefinite, as a war on terror must be, since, you know, there's no one country that you can defeat and defeat terror. If a war on terror is indefinite, then you're going to have an endless attack on civil liberties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Howard, we are running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one last question.
Sure.
Do you think much about your legacy?
Do I think much about my legacy?
Yeah.
Well, not really.
Really?
And, no. Well, yeah. What can I say about my legacy? Do I think much about it? A little. I guess maybe we all do. Although, I like to think that I'm somehow leaving behind enough. Two writings and. That will continue to help people and even inspire people, and I like to think that I'm leaving behind. As you say, I'm all ready to go tomorrow. I'm leaving behind people whose lives I've touched in some way, and I hope a good way. And you know, that's the most that all of us can do. I don't think, you know, if somehow we have had an effect on one person in our life in such a way as to, you know, leave that person wiser, more active, more just, then, you know, that's a good legacy.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Howard Zinn.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.